And I also got myself some coffee. Very important. I don't know if you've been finnified in your stay in Finland.
I mean, I have not drank coffee before I moved here, really, on a routine basis. Now I kind of do, but I try to keep my addiction in check, really, as far as it's possible.
Yeah. Yeah, I had to cut down a little bit. Also because it you get some stomach problems if you drink too much, so maybe two or
Yeah.
three cups a day. That's not nine like my Finnish friend.
Yeah. I think, well, if you work on the computer, it kind of lends itself to excessive coffee consumption.
Oh yes. Oh yeah, without coffee the Swedish society would basically grind to a halt.
Welcome to the Elosa podcast. Today I'm interviewing Thomas Hardin, who has a master in computer science and is currently studying in his own time linear programming theory. I first became aware of Thomas's work through YouTube. I watched a talk that he did at the Marx 22 conference and know that he has some links with another cybernetic socialist planner or someone who works in that field called Paul Cockshott, who also does YouTube videos. But I think it's best if you just introduce yourself, Thomas, and tell the audience a bit what you do in your daily life.
Yeah, so my name is Thomas Hedin, and I live in northern Sweden in a town called Umeå. So, and I, apart from working in with computer stuff, I work in broadcast video basically for my day job, and currently I've been researching. Well, basically, I read Capital by Karl Marx around. I think I started reading it around 2017 or so, and I noticed a lot of connections between the kind of stuff that we're taught in computer science regarding, you know, how to, you know, graph theory and things like. Well, there's a lot of linear algebra stuff in there, so there's like a connection to the stuff I already know, and then I start realizing. I started looking into planning because basically a friend of mine locally thought that, well, obviously this is the solution to the climate situation. And initially I just kind of laughed at them, like, what do you mean planning? I mean, that didn't work, you know. But then they kind of look at it and go like, well, actually it did work for quite a long time in the Soviet Union, for example. And you start to kind of look at, well, what did they actually do? And sort of why did they stop doing it? You know, why did they go to the market? Things like that. And that's been a kind of an interest there. And then I read Cockshott's work, especially Towards a New Socialism. And I noticed, you know, a lot of similarities to the kind of stuff I was thinking about when I'm reading Capital and I'm looking at the climate situation. I noticed that there's an entire literature on this subject, on economic planning. And very few people are talking about it, and it's very much not in fashion at the moment, but I feel like it's more and more people are starting to become aware of it.
Yeah, I think you can just basically continue on that train of thought and explain why do you think market solutions don't work, or what are the advantages of planning?
Right. So there are, of course, several problems with the current, you know, capitalist system. And from a climate perspective, one problem is that there is no coherent coordination at all. So there is nothing really stopping me from going down to the gas station, buying a whole drum of gasoline and just burning it, for example. Or there is nothing really preventing me from a whole bunch of stuff like, you know, as long as I can make money off it, it's likely to be done. So it because, for example, emissions are not a commodity, it is not in the interest of the bourgeoisie to curtail emissions in any way, because they, you know, it's just, to them, it's an externality, or what the bourgeois economists call an externality. And so there are some attempts to regulate this or somehow keep it in check. So, for example, the emissions trading system that's currently in place. But all it's really doing is, it's just, at least in Sweden, what they've done is they've apportioned these emission, what are they called in English? Utsläppsrätter in Swedish.
I think they're carbon certificates or something, CO2 certificates, something like this.
Yeah, let's call them CO2 certificates. And what they've done is those who have historically emitted lots of, you know, emissions, they get a larger allotment of these, and everyone else gets, you know, they're given to the companies to make use of. And so therefore there is an incentive, because if they actually emit less than this, they're going to get a lower allotment. So there is an incentive for companies to actually, well, increase emissions even to ensure that their allotment doesn't go down. There's a lot of stuff like that. It's not democratic at all. Like, at least a better system would be if everyone got these certificates and you sold them to the companies, for example, or you could withhold them if you wanted to. So that system, you know, it has lots of problems. And that's besides things like the capitalist firm being exploitative. You know, basically none of these workplaces are democratic. Either you do what your boss tells you or you're fired. And yeah, so there is both a practical aspect where the capitalist production is chaotic in a sense. Like it kind of, it's a bit of a drunk walk through the state space of the economy or whatever. It basically has no means with which to rein in its emissions. I think all of your listeners will recognize this, that companies, you know, nothing really stops them. Or even if we take Sweden, for example, you have the Cementa, the big calcination plant on, I believe, Gotland. So they take limestone, they burn it, and that's where you get, what is it called, unslaked lime, which you then use to make cement and then use to make concrete. And you would think, because the government is the one that hands out permissions for this, you would think if they were serious about their, you know, CO2 emissions goals, because this is a process that releases maybe 20% of, no, not 20, but 10% or so of Sweden's emissions, you would think they would be restrictive with this. But of course, that would threaten jobs and like GDP. So of course, they're going to keep giving permission for this. So there is no really way for the politicians to actually check this. And so I see a lot of environmentalists are kind of like, well, the politicians have to do something, but the problem is they can't, because they are still, they have to be compatible with the market, and the market demands profit. It is basically, because we are living in this neoliberal era, there is no way to really in the current system to really get out of that.
Yes. So the fundamental problem of the capitalist state having to serve the capitalist interest first and foremost, otherwise you will have outward migration of capital and all these kind of things. And I think to the regulation aspect of industries, like, interesting to note that capital, of course, is not a force for regulation, but usually against environmental regulation and worker safety and these kind of things, because of course that's part of increasing their costs. Like if you can, I don't know if you can just let the waste of your textile factory run off into the local waterways, you might have a massive die of fish population and other aquatic life, but your factory runs cheaper, even though it fucks up the local ecosystem and probably some fisheries nearby. But yeah. So I guess we already run into the problem of the political will, as you call it last time we talked. So can you talk a bit about maybe the feasibility of planning then? Because of course we know markets are feasible to a degree, not totally of course, because there's always state subsidies that have to be, like we see right now with the kind of mini banking crash, I guess you can call it, where the banks have to be bailed out in order for the financial systems not to collapse. Like state intervention.
And there's a big, there's a big crash coming as well. In a year.
We'll see if they can control it in any way, but certainly looks like the 2008 saving of the economy with low interest rates of the federal banks and European Central Bank and stuff which has prolonged the crisis for a while, is now coming to an end. But we'll see if it comes to that.
Mm. To get back to your question, so let's see here. So you asked, you asked if it's feasible, or what makes it more feasible now, we could say. And one major thing, if we go back in time here to roughly 1920, where this sort of discussion around planning starts, really, I mean, starts to be taken seriously. You have people like Otto Neurath, who puts forth various proposals after the Great War, after the First World War, saying that the techniques that were used to plan the war economy could be used for peaceful ends as well. And then there's kind of a discussion about this in the Bavarian Soviet Republic, which was a short-lived socialist experiment in southern Germany. And then in 1920, you have sort of the right-wing reaction to this with von Mises and Hayek, who basically say, no, you can't do that. And then in 1921, you have the founding of Gosplan in the Soviet Union. And Gosplan is founded to help with the efforts to electrify the Soviet Union, or the problems they have, basically. So they have to figure out a way to sort of coordinate all these different resources that they have in physical terms rather than in money terms. So they know that they have to build such and such, you know, many kilometers of electricity wire, and they need such and such much steel, etc., etc. And they set to work doing this, and they, as far as I can tell, their sort of methods are crude. It's sort of ad hoc, and what they have are, you know, pen, paper, and adding machines, basically. So things like computers, of course, hadn't been invented in 1921. A computer in that time was a person. So computer was a job title, someone who computes. But they do manage to make it work. Like in the early Soviet period, they used the system to industrialize rapidly. So it does work, and through the Second World War as well. So through this entire sort of period, this is all done by hand. It sort of has its limitations because it's a rather slow and bureaucratic system. So it has these issues with reacting to changes, basically. And this is a feature of the Soviet system up until roughly the late 80s, when they start to want to modernize this, using, you know, computers and computer networks and stuff like that. But unfortunately, it's kind of too late at that point. So the union is dissolved, and we get the 90s and all the horror. Anyone who's read about Russia in the 90s or the former Soviet Union in the 90s will know what I'm talking about here. But it's basically the entire system just, you know, overnight, basically. I don't know what the unemployment rate goes up to, like 20% or more.
Basically, you have all the negative impacts of like a wartime situation without having a war. Like, it's basically as if someone had came along and bombed all the industries because everything was sold out and shut down.
Overnight. Because they had a system of planning which was far from perfect. But it did function. It had sort of slowed down during sort of the 70s under Brezhnev. They call it a stagnation, but the economy was still growing. It was just, you know, they weren't seeing the 10% per year that they saw in the 30s and 40s and 50s. But still, you know, it was a functioning system, although it was slow to react. It was sort of bureaucratic, not particularly democratic, let's say, and it was still, you know, a lot of pen and paper involved. So if we compare this to what so sort of the modern theory of planning, which is rather different, because we start, you know, it's been 30 years or more, and we do have computers everywhere now, and we have internet, so we can make sure that the, you know, these things don't have to take months. They can take, you know, a couple of hours at most. So you start being able to have a more dynamic system for this kind of stuff. So that's kind of where this is coming from at the moment, let's say. So whereas before, if you go like to the 1920s, they were saying like, okay, this cannot be done. And then, you know, the Soviet Union goes and does this, and it turns out you can, but it, you know, it has these problems which are due to basically technological limitations and also some theoretical gaps, let's say, to the present situation, where the conclusion basically what everyone is how do you explain this? I think everyone is in agreement that it can be done. It's more like things like, how do you get worker input in this? How do you capture the tacit knowledge that people have? Things like that. And how do you democratize it? It's more these kinds of aspects.
The conception many people have, I think, about the plan, the 5-year plans, for example, is a bit wrong anyway, because the plan wasn't, they didn't write down a plan for 5 years and then they never changed it.
No.
But nowadays, of course, especially with computers and access to the internet and the making the task of getting input and feedback from the system much easier, the direction is very clearly toward a more like the cybernetic version of a plan. So maybe you could talk a bit about the differences and what's the advantage of planning cybernetically.
Right. So cybernetics is all about, you know, feedback systems and, you know, control systems, basically. So in order for, say, a system of planning to actually be able to function, you need input to the system. So the system needs to know, you know, if something happens, like, you know, a train derails or whatever, then as long as you put that into the system can sort of plan around it. And because we have modern algorithms for this, it can do this quite rapidly, you know. Yeah, again, on the order of a couple of hours, maybe. It kind of depends what we're talking about here. But the emphasis is very much on feedback and sort of steering rather than commanding, let's say. So what planning actually is that instead of calculating things in terms of money, you're instead calculating things in physical terms. So instead of, you know, looking at an economy in terms of the number of euros produced, you're instead thinking in terms of, well, how much carbon emissions do we have enough hospital beds, Do people have enough potatoes and shoes and socks and so on? So you're thinking in, you know, in terms of concrete actual things rather than this abstract thing we call money. And any means of payments that might exist in the system play very much a sort of a secondary role. So if you have means of payment in the system, they are more for regulating demand rather than organizing production. So you look at sort of each workplace as a unit, and the goal of the software, so to say, is to make sure that all these units fit together so that they, you know, I know if I work at a place that cuts logs into boards, for example, that I know where my logs are coming from and where the board should go. That can be sort of worked out automatically. But then there are other things like what kind of boards do we want to make? Those are sort of decisions that have to be made by the workers themselves working with this. Sort of we know what we can and cannot make. And so that has to be put in. And that's sort of a from the ground up kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, local limitations for sure. And then, of course, also what the plan requires. Like, if you need certain kinds of boards, then you have to cut certain number of boards. But I think what's interesting to emphasize about this is also that when you use money in an economy, then basically you conflate all different kinds of attributes in Marxism, use values, or the basically you conflate use values into an exchange value, so into a common number, but that doesn't reflect at all the qualities of the thing that I'm holding. Like if I buy a drill or something from the store, or I don't know, something, some tool, then I can drill with that, but the number that it costs 200 euros doesn't tell me anything about what I'm able to do with 200 euros. Like, if 200 euros is a universal thing that I can go and buy things with, but I can't drill a hole with 200 euros. So I have to exchange that for the use value of a drill.
Yes.
And the idea, I guess, with a plan there is that you calculate what's needed, not in terms of money, but in terms of actual use value. So actual specific things that you need.
Yes. And also you can account for these things. That's perhaps the most important. So that's another way to look at it, is you're sort of accounting for things in, you know, again, in physical terms. So you know that it takes such and such amount of iron ore, for example, to make a drill bit. And it takes a certain number of kilowatt hours of electricity and so on. And all of these activities have emissions tied to them. They also require a certain amount of labor in order to be performed. In some cases, it might be possible to automate them. So you might, for example, be able to reduce the amount of labor. But this requires an upfront investment. So there's all of these kind of different things that you have to weigh against each other. And again, luckily, we can let a computer take care of that heavy lifting. And then instead we can sort of focus politics on things like, well, where do we want to have our iron mines, for example? Maybe we shouldn't have them in Kallak, for example. Those would be then explicitly formulated in a way that the plan solver can go, let's move the mining to another place instead.
Yeah. And I think it lends itself quite well at this point to talk about environmental constraints as one of the constraints. Like, obviously you can't perform more labor than you have available, or you can't use up more electricity that you can. And in the same vein, you can not produce more carbon than is okay to stay within planetary boundaries, right?
Yes, that is correct. So because we are looking at things in physical terms, we can also put in constraints in physical terms. So just as you say, just as we have only so many you know, labor hours available per year, we can only allow so much emissions per year. And preferably the total emissions, you know, emissions minus sequestration, ought to be at least a negative number. And currently it's a positive number and it's accelerating. So we, and when you start doing that, you can be like, well, okay, so we can sort of, we can put in constraints that say that the emissions should be, you know, minus, I don't know, 1 gigaton the first year and minus 3 gigatons and then minus 10. And then at some point in the future, we might put a constraint that says, okay, at this time, let's say 2050, then we should have the atmospheric amount of carbon dioxide be equal to 1900. I think it's 300 ppm or something.
Yeah, 350 or something, and they take different measurements. I think 1850, start of the Industrial Revolution, but the one that's more agreed upon is 1990.
Yeah. So you
actually, yeah, insane. I just recently found out that the atmospheric concentration of CO2 doubled since 1990, which is just absurd to think about.
That. No, not the, that has to be the emissions, not the total amount.
Ah, okay.
Because if you double, you actually start getting like sluggish. If you have, if it would actually be doubled, you would start to see CO2 poisoning. That's which true, we probably will never reach, or if we do, that would be horrifying.
Yeah, when you go up to 700 parts per million or something, then it's gonna be
just, you start having problem.
Another,
you start becoming stupid, sort of.
aren't we already?
Yeah, well, stupider, I guess. But basically, you can put in an explicit constraint for this, and you can actually be assured that the economy doesn't release more than that. Relatively surely, of course, there's still some uncertainty. It's not always perfectly accounted for, and so on. But
yeah, and there's of course the kind of tipping points and stuff where that are hard to calculate. I think that even the IPCC is not considering, because they just can't know.
No. But you can actually put in, you can to an extent put in a model for them.
At
least insofar as if they're linear, which even a linear model gets you pretty far, you can kind of guess that, well, okay, so if the emissions keep increasing, then also you're going to get more melting in the, for example, in Siberia and so on, which is already happening anyway. It's going to keep on happening. Or even if we fix things, let's say, it'll take, it's going to take like 100 years. I think the ocean temperature is one of these things that even if we get things under control, it will keep rising anyway. And then in maybe 100 years, it'll have stabilized. But this is something we can actually put in. Like, okay, what's the effects of this on? Because if the seas get warmer, they release CO2. So we will have to put labor into sequestering yet more CO2 to compensate for this. And there are various industrial processes we can use. For example, arboriculture, I think is the English word, so forestry. There are various ways to use, you know, like, yeah, various land use ways you can do. But you actually have to, while you're doing this, you, of course, have to ensure that you're producing enough food and so on for, you know, for people to actually be able to live. And that is also like a constraint. Like, you have to ensure that there's enough calories being produced. You have to ensure there's enough hospital beds, that there's public transit, things of that nature.
I think it's interesting also to point out, I mean, of course, planning in itself is not a wonder cure. It is more effective than more chaotic market. And actually, second thought, YouTube channel put out a very good video recently, quite like an easy, accessible way to get into this topic, of how the biggest corporations, Amazon and Walmart and others, already plan their internal economies. And basically just have these contact points outside where they use the exchange value the money form to buy things that they can't produce or distribute domestically. Like basically, you can think about if there's a Walmart store and a Walmart depot, then they don't. The driver that takes the stuff from the depot doesn't have to pay the depot and then gets money from the store for the driving, but instead, of course, it's all internal organization. It just makes sense when you think about it like that. So planning's already a huge part of our globalized economies, and of course any capitalist firm will also try to have as stable supply chains as possible, because then you know you can calculate how much will you be able to output, how much will you be able to, you know, how much storing space you need, and all these kind of things, how much workers you need on any given day. So there is always a certain amount of planning involved.
So yes, and there's like an internal process for this. Again, there's a bit of haggling as well, but for example, Walmart, they prefer simply purchasing their suppliers and then incorporating their production process into Walmart. And this makes the goods cheaper, because Walmart doesn't have to pay for, they don't have to pay the profit that is required to, they don't have to pay the premium that is required for their suppliers to make a profit. So that means that the goods that they're buying are cheaper. And this can be quite substantial, depending on the volumes involved, but it's generally cheaper for them to simply buy the company that makes, I don't know, shoes or whatever.
There is a counter argument to that, but that's a bit more economic in question than that. But the counter argument to raise it really quick is that if you have multiple firms, and usually, for example, clothing manufacturers in Bangladesh and Indonesia that compete with each other, then they will drive down each other's prices, and then the buyer at the end of the supply chain, Walmart, that buys the shirts from them, can actually decide and play them off against each other. And also then those smaller producers have to exert again pressure on their governments to drive down real wages so they can produce cheaper than their competitors. Or this kind of and you see this in different industries, but that of course lends itself to this global imperialist system where the North controls even businesses in the South through being the only ones that can buy, basically.
Yeah, and they push up what we call the rate of exploitation. So, or equivalently, they're pushing down the wage rate. So your Bangladeshi seamstress maybe gets paid, you know, equivalently for 8 hours per week. And the rest of, you know, if we assume a 40-hour work week, but these people probably have an 80-hour work week, but they're basically the rest of the time, they're not getting paid at all. That just goes to profits. And still Walmart can.
It's more than that even, but there's a whole book that there's many, of course, but there's one that I read which deals with this issue, which is called Imperialism in the 21st Century. And but in that, John Smith is the author of that one, and he basically breaks it all down where along the supply chain or the production and distribution process, where is the value actually captured. He uses the word captured because, according to Marxian economics, the use value of a shirt is produced, of course, already at the point of production in the Bangladeshi factory, because after that, not much happens. Like everything about the product is done, and then it's just distributed and sold, and no value is added through this process of distributing and selling in material terms. But most of the value is captured after the production has already taken place.
Small point there is. One case where extra value is added, and that is in transportation. So there is a certain amount of necessary labor required to transport the shirts from Bangladesh to, you know, Europe. And that transport labor also adds a little bit of value. So that is in volume 2 of Capital. But the distribution as such does not add value. That would be a bourgeois incorrect thing. But actually, the necessary transport, because it is again necessary, it does add a little bit of value.
Yeah, of course, to get it to the consumer.
But that's maybe a rather finer point.
Well, I guess we talked about exploitation under a capitalist system now, and of course, planning is quite closely linked in people's minds with socialism, although we kind of told the people now that also under capitalism, planning occurs. But maybe you can talk a bit about the implications, the democratic implications of planning, because now, of course, most people are working in capitalist businesses where they have no ownership over the means of production, and also they don't have any democratic control over what they produce and how they produce.
Right. So we could say that the main difference here is that in the capitalist firm, planning happens within the firm, and as you say, it's coordinated through exchange value with other firms. So they're kind of islands of planning connected by the market. And these connections are rather, let's say, narrow. It's only in terms of price. But the point that we're making is you're instead of having planning restricted to the firm, you instead bring planning to a societal level. So you sort of socialize the planning. And this is necessary in order to democratize it. And as you say, you know, the capitalist firm is basically despotism. You have very little say. I mean, if you have a strong union, then you can have a bit of say. But it's still, ultimately, it's the capitalists that have final word. Because otherwise, I mean, they can just shut down the business, move everything somewhere else where, you know, workers are not as well organized. And this does happen. And then, so it's a bit of like a hostage situation.
Yeah. Yeah, this is also the place, if you want to understand capitalist states, that's the way we have to understand them, that ultimately, because they uphold private ownership and they will not seize the means of production, that they are subservient to capital, because two things, capital strikes and I don't know what the second, capital flight is the second word for it, where capitalists leverage their power of ownership to withhold production or stop production, to basically in the same way that workers would in a strike, to force the government to agree to their demands. And then the second is capital flight, where they just like you said, can move productive facilities overseas or just pull funding. I mean, ultimately, it's their factory. If they want to stop buying produce, want to stop hiring workers and invest everything in, I don't know, some creditors, some loans or something, which is, I mean, what we see with the massive financialization, where people can make money without having to do any production, right? So you just loan money, so then you don't have to worry about anything, just have to worry about the fact that people pay back their loans. And that's, again, a function of the capitalist state to enforce this. So maybe a bit, I mean, you know a bit about the cyber socialism that was attempted in Chile, and maybe also a bit, you can talk a bit about worker feedback and also workers planning directly in their workplaces and how that would be a part of the socialist plan.
Yes. So they, let's see here if I can get the history wrong, because the history right. I mean, what happens is Allende gets into power, and you have under Allende a guy called Fernando Flores, I believe his name is pronounced, and he has kind of he's aware of these sort of ideas, and he's aware of at this time management cybernetics is starting to become a thing in the West. And so what he does is he brings in a British management consultant called Stafford Beer, who is sort of sympathetic to the Chilean cause, and he's written on this stuff, and he has a very Beer has something, a model that he calls the viable system model, and it sort of emphasizes how to deal with variety and how to sort of ensure that there's sufficient feedback in the system to deal with variety as local as possible. So Bear has this kind of model, and it goes to, I believe, to Allende and says that, like, look, we would like to do, I believe both he and Fernando Flores goes to Allende. I'm a little bit unsure about the details, but what they do is basically go, we have an idea how we can do like a democratized, computerized system of planning here, where we can get each of the workplaces connected to a computer system, and we can get sort of up-to-date production statistics to sort of collect this information and ensure that the economy is running as smoothly as possible. And this gets the green light, and they get some funding for this. There are, of course, some problems, like they only have something like 3 computers in this system, and then the rest of it is mostly as teletypewriters, so basically very thin clients that connect to this, these computer centers. But the workers are able to use it. They are, for example, able to use this system, which is called CyberSyn, to plan around a reactionary strike in the transportation sector. So all the truck drivers, who are mostly, you know, small business people, they do not like Allende. So they get help from the Americans, and they run a rather well-coordinated strike. I believe mostly around the city centers, so I'm not 100% sure of the geographical distribution of these. But using this system, this cybernetic planning system, the Allende government is able to sort of route around these strikes and to sort of keep the economy going. Because during all this, of course, the Americans are applying pressure. They want Allende gone. I believe the words used by the CIA is that they want to make the Chilean economy scream. So they are absolutely, you know, because what Allende does or threatens to do is to nationalize things like the copper industry. And of course, the owners of the copper mines don't want that. So, you know, they call their buddies up in Washington and are like, hey, can you do something about this? And so eventually the Americans do. They successfully carry out a coup. They bomb the presidential palace in Chile.
Yeah. I mean, what's the guy that came into power after him? I should know this.
That's Pinochet.
Yeah, Pinochet does it himself. He gets advice from the CIA and funding and stuff like that. So,
yeah, I mean, yes. So of course he gets cooed. So, and of course they dismantle this system immediately, because this is sort of when neoliberalism starts getting going, and they use Chile as the sort of patient zero for neoliberalism. So they do sort of an extreme form of liberalization of the economy. So it's, you know, an extreme 180 degree turn compared to what Allende wanted to do, and you know, including torture and God knows what else. So this project gets dismantled. So it basically, what they had showed a lot of promise. So they had a lot of stuff they wanted to do, but of course they had very little time to do it. This, I believe it was 2 years that they, well, yeah, if Allende got elected in 71, I believe, and then he was deposed in 73. So in this time, they still managed to sort of prototype a lot of systems around this. They have like a digital forum system, and they have, of course, for production statistics and all manner of other systems. And I shouldn't say too much because I'm not clear on the details, but they get some kind of prototype system going, and this is again in the 70s, so we don't have proper internet. The computers are very
primitive. I watched this recently. There's an interesting John Pilger documentary on, well, it's a bit more broad. It also treats Venezuela and other other left-wing governments. Also, I think Ecuador on Bolivia. But yeah, it's a bit older, but it's quite good. And he talks about in that also about Chilean socialism. And there, the documentary is called "The War on Democracy." Came out in 2007. And then there was also a very good YouTube video about this, more about the planning aspects of the Chilean economy, like focused on that specifically, but also talks about the historical circumstances quite a bit, which is on YouTube. That's called, I think it's just called Cyber Socialism. Let me check. By the Plastic Pills.
Oh, yeah, I think I've seen it.
I think that's an awesome, like, that's a 1 hour documentary that he did, like, a very small channel that has usually like 20,000 views on the videos or something. It's called Cyber Socialism Project Cybersyn and the CIA coup in Chile. So that's very good.
I believe I've seen, it's probably better to look at that than listen to my somewhat not perfect historical knowledge here, but
yeah,
the gist of it is that they,
The thing that I remember about the Democratic, they had it like a demo, or they had plans at least, because they had lots of plans what to do with the system, and everything got shut down before they could, they started using it, like you said, in the against the reactionary strikes, but they never, of course, were able to develop it to a degree that they wanted to. So one part of the system would have been like a democratic feedbacks mechanism, where basically you just have, like, when you're done with your work, then you just have like three options. Like, after your shift ends, basically you give like a feedback, so like, were you happy, unhappy, or like okay. And the idea was that it would be anonymized, and then basically would be like put together in the central planning office. You could see if there was if workers were unhappy in a workplace, you would be able to intervene and try to address the problems that made them unhappy before it would come to a full blown strike or any kind of
I believe that, like, Beer calls this algodonic feedback, which comes from combining the words for pain, which is algesia, I believe, and of course for pleasure would be hedonia. So the algodonic feedback for, you know, pain or pleasure, you know, so that the people one step above you have some idea of what's going on. And the model that Beer has is sort of a multi-tiered model. So at every level in the system, you want to not have to concern yourself with anything more than the level immediately below and immediately above. So you can kind of, this also means that sort of the further up you go in the system, the more sort of aggregated these statistics are, and the more sort of, the less you can directly command things. It's more like you steering. The word cybernetics comes from the Greek word for helmsman. So the model is that you're kind of, you can only give sort of very high level sort of steering.
Inputs.
So you can't really fully do it, and there is both there is an attenuation of the amount of data going up, and there is an attenuation in the amount of control going down, let's say. So I believe that's Beer's point, as you want to keep these systems as flat as possible. But of course they cannot be completely flat, because you always need some kind of regional coordination, and then national, and then ultimately international and global. But you want to kind of be cognizant of the limitations of sort of what you can actually do from a
And I mean, this is very logical when you think about it. Even under capitalism, of course, there's like a the federal bank, or like the Fed in the United States, sets an interest rate, and the European Central Bank does the same. And of course, in this system that we live in now, it's geared towards serving the interest of the capitalist class. But you can easily imagine in a socialist society that you would set, for example, growth targets, or like we said, like limits on carbon emissions to guide the general direction of the economy, and then it's executed in smaller local branches.
And so that's the point we've been trying to make, me and Dave Zakaria, is that, for example, at the global level, the kind of decisions you can make are very sort of general. So you can maybe decide that, well, let's say atmospheric composition. So you could make, you would have to actually make an explicit political decision somehow, but it does have to apply sort of globally. Because again, the atmosphere is global. So, you know, it's kind of unavoidable. But you cannot, for example, centrally decide whether we're going to build, I don't know, a playground here in Umeå or whatever. I mean, that would be silly. So there is a sort of a...
Yeah, I think we can bring it to a close slowly. There's just one more thing that came to my mind that I want to point out. The analogy that Second Thought uses in his video is that basically it's like a planning game. Like he uses the example of Settlers of Catan, but I guess that there's a lot of strategic or like real-time strategy games or like turn-based strategy games on computer that you can compare planning with, where you deal in kind, so with actual resources and not with money equivalents. There's one game that I played that is quite good, which is called Half Earth. The book is called Half Earth Socialism, that the game is based on, and you can play the game for free on half.earth, or you can go to Steam and download it there. And this is kind of a card-based planning game. It's quite rudimentary in some aspects, but I think it really is really good to convey the idea of what planning actually means and how different policies and economic plans can change the systems that you're dealing with, and kind of I think shows off these feedback mechanisms quite well. So I think that's something to check out if you're interested in trying this for yourself. Also, not so easy to beat the game. I think you have to have quite a good understanding what certain policies do if you want to beat that.
Yeah, you can kind of min-max the early game, actually.
Yeah.
But it's, you have to play it a couple of times before it kind of, like, and things, certain investments are, you want to do as early as possible. This is a typical thing, but when you do, when you set up these systems and solve them on the computer will typically prefer to make investments as early as possible, because there's, you know, you make an upfront investment and then you save labor down the road.
Yeah.
So, and there's a similar thing in Half-Earth Socialism, where they like, okay, well, you can make rather cheap things early on that over time pay off.
Yeah.
So to say.
Yeah, yeah, like reduction in birth rates through family planning, or like 10% increase in crop yields or something, of course, is like, doesn't seem that much, but if you add it up over time, then it makes huge difference. And I mean, this is the case with research and development in the real world anyway. Like, if you do research early, then you get to benefit from it later on. But there's, of course, like, you have to weigh the options and see what works best. But if you talk about, for example, climate policy, what we see, what's quite well shown in these graphs by the IPCC and stuff, is that if you reduce carbon emissions late, then you have to absorb a lot of the carbon out of the atmosphere again after 2050, when you want to reach this net zero goal.
So yeah, it's a lot harder.
Yeah, so the earlier you start, the easier it is. But of course, the political will is what's lacking at the moment, like we summarized a few times already.
I think in Half-Earth Socialism, they make kind of the charitable assumption that, okay, we do have a world revolution and everyone is on board. It's kind of the best starting scenario, which is, of course, in reality, it's going to be much, much harder. But we'll see.
Nothing's impossible.
No, you have to be optimistic. Otherwise, I mean, I am very much against doomerism.
Yeah, me too. I mean, this is what we're doing. This is exactly like raising political awareness about how to approach these topics.
Yeah. And perhaps we should say, I mean, a lot of what I'm doing apply that sort of strategic minded, let's say, because there's a lot of in the climate movement, there's a lot of focus on tactics and there's basically no strategy at all. Which is a little bit, because you have to have an answer for things like, well, how are you going to get, you know, the things that people need? How are you going to actually produce them? Unless you suggest that people are going to live in tiny self-sustaining communes, which some do propose, but that also means that you basically give up access to modern medicine, a whole bunch of stuff like that. So, which I am, you know, that's going to lead to people dying, which is, not good.
Yeah, not preferred. I think what we want to do is try to make as smooth a transition as we can, but we do have to make the transition. That's quite obvious. That's quite clear, I think.
Mm. Let's see. Do you think, would the listeners be interested in any of the sort of technical stuff or the math behind it? Or
I think you can mention it for as like a little teaser, and then I'll just put your blog in the description and people can link up with you if they want to.
So I could mention them, or maybe you want to do an introductory question there, I don't know.
So Thomas, what are you working on right now?
So what I'm working on is currently a lot on linear programming, and this is the tool that we use to actually do planning. So, and it's what linear programming is solving a system of linear inequalities, so a system of constraints. And this turns out to be, let's say, both tricky and surprisingly not tricky. It's something that we're relatively good at. But for the people who might be more mathematically minded, they could, of course, read my stuff or, you know, check out the literature on linear programming, and also read, you know, some of the books that people who are active in this area, like Towards a New Socialism by Paul Cockshott and Alan Cottrell. And you mentioned Half-Earth Socialism, which I haven't read, but I hear it's good. I hear it brings up a lot of these things.
I'm not a fan, I have to say. I think there's better books to read. Yeah, this is very, my critique of the book would be that it's very utopian, not so much scientific. I mean, it drives the general point home, what we've been talking about, but I think just there's more specific books. Like, I think I'm going to read some stuff about degrowth, which is more specific, not to planning, but if you want to read about, I think it's smarter to read about planning and then to read about eco-socialism or whatever the trend is. On the other hand, and you get a better picture.
Then I guess probably the go-to book is Towards a New Socialism by Paul Cockshott and Alan Cottrell. Also the works of Otto Neurath, who was an Austrian Marxist and a mathematician, and also Leonid Kantorovich, who's a Soviet mathematician. And there's some other stuff, but if listeners are curious, they can contact me, and I can also send, you know, some papers on this stuff. There's a whole set of literature on this, let's say.
Okay, well, I think it's a good point to end. Thank you for talking to me today. I think this was very informative. And I will put all the links in the description so people can find what we've been talking about and find more resources to read up on and videos to watch. So do you have any last words?
Things may seem hopeless, but actually this is entirely doable. We can do planning, and through planning, we can deal with the climate situation.
Yes, I very much agree. Okay, thank you.
All right.
And goodbye, dear listeners.
Bye.